song that you have just sung reminds me of an incident many years ago when I had the privilege of being the chairman of the only public question meeting I understand that Brother Russell ever held. And being the chairman, I asked him what hymn he would prefer for opening. And his answer was, any one of the hymns except the one that begins, Ask Ye What Great Things I Know. I trust that there isn't a similar allusion tonight. But it is true that we do know great things, even if the world fails to recognize that fact on our behalf. I want to bring you the Christian love and greetings, of course, from my own home class in Portland and from the brethren in the Northwest. Before we left on this trip, we had a Northwestern meeting of the friends in Salem, Oregon. Knowing that we were contemplating making this trip, they requested that we convey their Christian love. And practically every class in the Northwest was represented. So I bring you their love. Also from the friends along the way. Our first stop was at Denver, Colorado, and then to Kansas City and the convention there, and the following Sunday after the convention, St. Joseph, Missouri, and at Lincoln, Nebraska, Topeka, Kansas, and St. Louis, and Chicago, and various points in states of Wisconsin, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa. So I haven't been altogether idle between Chicago and Paterson, New Jersey. The theme, as suggested, is brought to our attention by the Lord Himself, and it is a direct answer to the question that His disciples asked Him, recorded in the 24th chapter of Matthew, and therein He sketches and answers a number of events. And finally, with the 30th verse, He says, and then. This is a direct answer to their question. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. The word sign is a very familiar word. New Testament. Some translators render it signal. Really, the basic meaning of the word is evidence, proof. They ask the question, what shall be the evidence of your presence and the end of the age? There are three Greek words, different words, translated end in this 24th chapter, and each one of them have a different thought involved. And in that third verse, the word there is centelia. It means the completion of a plan, the ending of a scheme of matter that had its beginning, its progress, and would reach its termination. And of course, this plan, or scheme, or series of events involved the entire period of the Gospel age. His disciples were interested in what would be the proof that the Gospel age was ended, that the purpose of it was accomplished, and what events might mark that fact. You know, point of time, simply introduces a period of time. It isn't a single event in prophecy. It introduces a series of events. And if we keep this fact in mind, it helps us to grasp the significance of many of the prophecies that otherwise would be obscure, more or less so. Then there is the other occurrence of this word end, a different Greek word, telos, and that is found in the 14th verse, where the Lord says, this gospel of the kingdom, the gospel which he was preaching, the gospel which began to be spoken by our Lord, we're told, and was confirmed unto us, that is the apostles and the early church, by them that heard him, and then was handed down from generation to generation. And in the process of handing it down, various features were added, various points were clarified, because this is the natural progress in the unfolding of the divine plan of redemption. The word telos means a completion or the end. For instance, we have the word telescope, to see to the end. That is as far as you can, as vision as possible. And of course, with the telescope, our vision is greatly lengthened. We have a microscope, which means smaller power of vision of smaller things. So, and the other place in which this word occurs is found in the 31st verse, and it is in connection with the first sign that would mark the evidence, the first evidence of the presence of the Son of Man. And you remember that this reads, and he shall send his angels or his messengers with a great trumpet, the word sound of, believed to be an interpolation. He would send his messengers with a great trumpet. And this trumpet, of course, we understand to be the seventh trumpet, the last of a series of seven, which had been sounding all down through the whole of the gospel age. That is, the first one began to sound in the days of the apostles. And in each subsequent period, a trumpet sounded, and each additional trumpet added to the testimony of the one that preceded it. I am of the opinion that these seven trumpets, seven seals, seven messengers to the churches cover the same periods of time, representing the same periods of time from three different viewpoints, as it were, making complete the unfolding and revelation of the divine purpose in setting aside this gospel age. In some respects, the most important period in the three ages associated with the present evil world and introductory to the first age in that world to come, the millennial age. So, the end here is a peculiar Greek word, akron, and it means the extremity. From one extremity of the heavens to the other, not a single part of whatever is signified by the term heavens would be overlooked or omitted, and at this particular time. You know, we have a city down here in Ohio. They pronounce it with a short A rather than a long one, Akron. And I do not know how they happened to select that name, what is from this Greek word. Maybe when the original pioneer set down his stakes there, he decided he just about reached the end, at least of civilization as he knew it. But Akron, Ohio, originates from the same Greek source. Notice this sign, and the word in the Greek is either singular or plural, and we believe it has a plural thought associated with it because of the very fact that the Lord mentions four signs. And of course that is a plural evidence that would indicate his presence. And the heavens here, of course, we wouldn't think to be the atmospheric heavens or the astronomical heavens. These signs are not natural phenomena at all. They have to do with spiritual things. And they will appeal not to the physical senses so much as they're intended to appeal to the understanding, the mental senses and powers of the individual. The Lord appeals to our mind. Remember, according to the first chapter of Isaiah, the Lord invited those typical people to come and reason with him, to use their intelligence. And when the Bible speaks of light and so on, usually has in mind not so much natural light, although sometimes that's referred to figuratively, literally, but to intellectual light. Paul mentions this in the first chapter of Ephesians when he says, the eyes of your understanding being enlightened, you might know what is the hope of your calling, what is the glorious wealth of his inheritance in his saints. So in this gospel age, this is the period in which God is calling out from among mankind and developing a saintly, a sanctified class, a new creation. And this new creation to be one of the most important features in his great universe. The most stupendous manifestation of divine wisdom and power that has ever been exercised, past, present, and perhaps future. Bringing into existence a divine order of sons. So no wonder the disciples recognized that in some way they were candidates for some special honor and place in the Lord's plan, were interested in knowing something about when and how they might expect to realize their future reward. They didn't grasp it fully, of course, at the time they asked this question. They didn't begin really to grasp it until after Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit was given. And then the promises of God, which Peter refers to as exceeding great and precious promises, in contrast with hundreds of other promises in the Word of God, began to be recognized, to be understood. So that they knew, however, that the Lord had evidently some special purpose. He hinted at it. He even stated it from time to time in his ministry. But they were slow to grasp the real implications of his words at that time. Afterwards, they did come to understand. This sign is to be given in the heaven. This word, heavens, occurs quite frequently in the Old and New Testament. Sometimes it is used literally, and many times it is used figuratively. And of course, as the heavens are higher than the earth, naturally, in contrast, whatever the term heavens is intended to suggest It must of necessity suggest something that is superior to and higher than anything earthly or material. And often it is used to symbolize the ruling elements, the higher elements of society, that control and direct the other elements of society, organizing them and exercising power and authority over them. And the scriptures indicate that there are two separate phases in this. There is a religious phase or aspect, and there is a civil phase or aspect. You know, we live so close to religious things. We're so interested in the religious aspects of everything that we overlook the fact that the civil aspect is also a dominant factor, and nearly always completely dominant in the affairs of mankind. And the religious element is made subservient to the civil element and is used by the civil powers to accomplish its own selfish, ambitious ends. So, looking at the matter from that angle, sometimes we get a little clearer perspective in respect to the fulfillment of prophecy. So this sign or proof or evidences would be given in the heavens. And we can see that there is a certain necessity for this. That the Lord, when he comes in his second advent, comes to take over the dominion of earth. Remember that we are told by the prophet, "Unto thee shall it come, O thou tower of the flock, even the first dominion." And we are told with reference to Zedekiah and his dethronement that it would not be the same until he should come whose right it was, and it would be given unto him. And so he taught his disciples to pray, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." And this word kingdom, occurring 150 times in New Testament scriptures, has more than the simple thought of a governmental organization. It refers to the rulership that would exercise the powers through a governmental organization. Remember, Jesus told here on one occasion, "The kingdom of heaven is within you." That's the way the King James Version reads. But the Diaglot, correctly translating the Greek, gives a much better thought. The royal majesty of the kingdom is among you. So when you pray, "Thy kingdom come," you're praying for the royal majesty, his royal majesty, to be present, to take unto himself his power, and to exercise it in the affairs of man. When Jesus came in his first advent, he didn't go down into the slums, Jerusalem, any of the other cities. He went among the common people and so shaped his activities as to come in contact with the leaders of the people. And you remember, the common people received him gladly in many instances. There was a reason for this, a selfish reason for it. No doubt after he fed the 5,000, the knowledge of this sped rapidly throughout the length and breadth of Palestine and to neighboring countries. Here was a man who could solve all of the food problems by which they were confronted. Take a few fishes and a few loaves and multiply them into sufficient to feed 5,000, have 12 baskets full left over. And surely, if they were to have a king, that was the kind of a king they wanted. Jesus accused them of this selfish motive, that they were following him for the loaves and the fishes. I do not think that believers today are much different than believers were back there. And I often wonder to what extent maybe you and I, consciously or unconsciously, have accepted present truth and are serving the Lord with more or less of a selfish motive. We can get something out of it, maybe. And the cost will not be too great. And certainly we would like to be either on the right hand or the left hand, such a powerful authority in the heavens. You know, couple of the apostles' mother was interested in this matter from the same angle on behalf of her son. You can't blame that mother. Naturally, any mother would want to see her sons have a preference, whatever organization might ultimately be aligned with, have a preferred spot. So she wanted her sons to be put on, one on the right hand and the other on the left hand. They were goodly boys. Jesus appreciated that fact. And remember, he nicknamed them sons of thunder. And one of them, we're told, he reposed on the bosom of the Master. We're not to take that literally. That's just a phrase common in those days where one specially favored another. Why, he was said to rest on his bosom. You know, we take a lot of things literally, overlooking the fact that even in our times, with our language, we don't always expect a literal interpretation of the thing we state. So, Jesus informed her that this was something that wasn't in his power to give. You know, there are many things that Jesus could not of his own will do. He tells us so. I can of mine own self do nothing. As I hear, I speak. So, it wasn't in his power to grant. He didn't deny that the possibility that there would be such a favor to be given unto some. I know, good brother, I use that word possibly. I have a great deal of pity. I almost said sympathy. I think I have a great deal of sympathy for him. And he very graciously put Brother Russell on the right hand of the Lord in the kingdom and reserved the left hand for himself. Well, our mind sometimes takes strange, peculiar tendencies or directions. I trust this brother wasn't as responsible for his assumption as it would appear that he might have been. And that is true of all of us. So these heavens, which the Lord would give these signs, had to do with a ruling phase of the situation that he would find in his second presence. It was the heavens that rejected him in his first presence. The ruling element of Israel, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. And it must have been quite galling for the leaders of Israel at that date, rich and increased with goods and had need of nothing. They were the covenanted people of God. Paul asked the question, remember, what advantage has a Jew? Much every way, chiefly, that unto them was committed the oracles of God, and they knew it, and they gloried in it. And when Jesus came unto them, they saw in him no beauty that they could desire. He was so different from the type that they had imagined the Messiah would represent when he would really come. And you know, he was a very poor man. He tells us so. The foxes have their holes, and the birds of the air have their nest, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. He who was at one time the richest creature in all created universe, in all the heavens, the apostle tells us, laid aside all that, and for our sake became poor. So poor that he had no home of his own. To me, one of the saddest statements in all the Bible, most pathetic, was this. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. A perfect stranger in the world that he had created, among people who owed their very existence to his creative act as the masterwork of the great supreme architect of the universe. So in his second advent, he comes unto a similar class who claim to be the covenanted people of God, and in some respects, true. Many of them had made a covenant with the Lord by sacrifice, and thereby could claim to be the beneficiaries of the seraph phase of the Abrahamic covenant, even though they might not have understood the philosophy of it all. They had the promises, and they claimed them. They, in the 20th chapter, verse of the third chapter of Acts, Peter, under inspiration, tells us that the heavens must receive him. And he's speaking of the time when God would send Jesus Christ. And they, of course, the bad lot, for some peculiar reason, the only time in 44-45 occurrences of the Greek word, translates it retain. Every other instance translates it receive. And it means receive. So just as he came in his first advent to the religious world and the ruling element of his day, which happened that both the civil power and the religious authority was vested in the high priest, except for the fact that they, of course, were under the domination of that fourth empire, Rome, and Rome had their representative there. But so far as Israel was concerned, civil and religious power and authority was vested with their high priest, and the rulers who sat in Moses' seat, as the Lord declared. So in his second advent, the signs were to be given unto the same class. The religious leaders, of course, down in our day, the civil power in recent generations has been largely divorced from the religious authority, and yet there's always been a very close association between the two. Civil authority seeking to dominate and to control religious authority and to direct it to their own interests, and of course the religious leaders conspiring and seeking to undermine the civil authority and to get greater civil power in their own hands. Sometimes they succeeded down through the gospel age. And the first great evidence would be the sending of his angel, of his messenger, sound great trumpet. We understand that the seventh trumpet began to sound in 1874. It is the trump of God. we are told that the Lord in his second advent would descend from heaven with a shout, voice of the archangel, the trump of God, and then something would begin to happen among the dead. Not necessarily instantly, but it would mark the introduction of that period of time. And of course, shortly after 1874, I understand, that in 1878 came the resurrection of the sleeping saints. I'm an old-fashioned Bible student. And in 58 years, if anything, the truth that I learned in the beginning is even clearer today than it was at any time in the first decade of my experience in present truth. I have no doubt in my mind as to the accuracy. Of course, back there, some details more or less clouded in a way, but gradually the clouds have vanished more and more, and present truth is present truth, emphatically, presently, in a way that it has never been before. And I'm surprised sometimes by some of my brethren seemed to be losing the vision that was once theirs, and becoming disturbed over this, that, and the other matter. The second evidence has to do with the fig tree. And I think we all appreciate the fact that the fig tree seemingly is used symbolically as a symbol of the fleshly Israel, of that house of servants. And of course, Jesus, according to Luke, when he mentions the fig tree, he says, and all the trees. And there's a great variety of trees mentioned in the Bible, some of them under rather outstanding circumstances. The 60th chapter of Isaiah, picturing the setup of the kingdom. When the Lord begins to deal with his footstool, mentions four different types of trees. And, well, I was going to say strange to say, but it isn't strange after all, that these four kinds of trees are evergreen trees. And that should be significant. You know, one of the prophets, when he was asked, what seest thou? And he says, I see men as trees walking. And gradually his vision was corrected. He was relieved of his astigmatism, and he saw men as men. So trees are used significantly in the Bible, particularly here, the fig tree. When you should see it putting out its tender buds, began to bear leaves, I then know that the Son of Man is at the door. We have a beautiful illustration of this in connection with the message of the church at Laodicea. Remember what the Lord said to that church. Lo, I stand at the door and knock. If any man open unto me, I will come in and sup with him, and he with me. What a fellowship that was to be. And you know, you and I should have experienced that. There was a time when the Lord came knocking at the door of our hearts, the door of our understanding, and we opened up our hearts and minds to present truths, and he did come in, supped with us, and we with him, and what a banquet that has proved to be. As the prophet foretold Daniel. Oh, the blessedness of him that cometh to the 1335 days. And yet, sad to say, some do not seem today to be as greatly blessed or to be as greatly rejoicing in the blessings that they profess once to believe in. It's a sad commentary on our times, and yet it is true. The vision seems to be coming dim, dimmer as the days go by. Almost one would think that the statement of the prophet might be a process of fulfillment, running to and fro from the rivers unto the ends of the earth, seeking the word of the Lord, seeking something better than the word of the Lord. They once acknowledged and received, and of course they will find it anywhere else but where it is, where the Lord provided it, where the food is, the eagles have been gathered together. So this restoration of Israel is one of the signs of his presence. And you know, it's startling. I've got with me a compilation of extracts from Brother Russell's writings. I thought I was going to make a record of all of them, and I found out that it would take too many pages. And way back, many, many years ago, Brother Russell sang the first green foliage beginning to appear, buds beginning to appear on this typical fig tree, rejoiced in the fact. In one place, he mentions there are 50,000 Jews today in Palestine. And they're doing wonders in that country. More than 50 years ago. And he says that this is the sign of restitution. Three times he refers to it as evidence of restitution. Years and years ago, before some of you present here were even born. And I don't know but what he was right. In fact, I'm quite confident that he was right. These are just foreglings. I often wonder what he would say today if he was alive in the flesh and realized that there are 2 million Jews in Palestine. Descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, members of the fleshly seed of Abraham. And for the first time in more than 2,500 years, they exist as an independent nation. For more than 2,500 years, they were a subject people. Even when they had a national polity, they couldn't call their land or their souls their own. And look at it today. Signs of the presence of the Son of Man. Then you remember he calls our attention to the natural condition that we prevail. So different and so unusual. That is in scope what they had been experienced before. And that's where he refers to Noah, as it was in the days of Noah. Marrying and giving in marriage. Even we Bible students are marrying and giving in marriage. And there was a time, of course, I'm not speaking of altogether approvingly of that time. We were learning. We were growing, and marriage was frowned upon. And now it's almost anything else. And we're glad. The Lord said that was one of the signs of his presence. Whether we fail to have part in the sign or not. The point that the Lord is making in this marrying, giving in marriage, and building and planting. Oh, if you travel over the country, as we've traveled over recent years, you're literally amazed, you're astounded at the building projects. Down in one place outside Los Angeles, one project alone, 23,000 homes with schools, markets, and everything of that kind. Why, no one ever saw anything like that in his day, I'm sure. And I don't think the world has seen anything like it down through the centuries. It has been evident, peculiarly so, in the last several decades, particularly since the last war. But the point that he's making, he's not criticizing marrying or building and planting. In fact, he says at that time, in respect to Israel, that he would build them again and not tear them down. He would plant them and not pluck them up. And I am quite confident that what's going on over there is rather permanent. Oh, there may be threats. The 83rd Psalm describes exactly the situation there today and for several past years, and it points out definitely that when the crisis comes, the Lord will be found on the side of Israel, even if many Bible students won't be. So they knew not. That's the thing the Lord is emphasizing. They knew not. They're going along their ordinary ways of life. And you remember, Peter says that that attitude of mind would be present among the Lord's people too. They'll be saying, where's the sign of his presence? For since the fathers have fallen asleep, all things continue as they have from the beginning. Since Brother Russell's passing, right, all things are just going on. Nothing happened. I find, brethren, to think that nothing has happened. Well, I think it would do them good if they took a trip over to Europe, even to England, or over into Germany. I met a brother just a few days ago who'd been over in Poland this past year, and he could tell you something about what trouble the brethren there had experienced. Yes, we're sitting here happily, prosperously. And by the way, we Bible students have never been so prosperous in the past 80 years as we are today. Many of us. I remember old Brother Sullivan. Perhaps some of you recall Brother Sullivan, tall, angular brother with a long beard. Almost stone deaf, could hardly hear his own voice. And he would come into a home. We had some of them then, not as many as we have now, but luxuriously furnished and everything, and he'd look around. He'd say, no sacrificing here, no sacrificing here. Well, he wasn't always right. And that, you can't always tell. But they sometimes wonder. That's all. So, knew not. Where is the sign of his presence? Then the fourth sign, a very important one, and it has to do with a work, a peculiar work, which the Lord prophesied he would do, and which many would be reluctant to believe, even though a man declared it unto them. And that's carrying out in a most remarkable and unusual way a policy that has been in effect ever since the days of Enoch, of using a human being, not all human beings, not an editorial, not a society, not an ecclesia, but an individual as his spokesman, his mouthpiece, through whom he would send his message unto his people. So this has been a peculiar feature of the end of the gospel age. He raised up a slave. That's what the Greek word is, a slave. But an unusual slave. You know, that word in the Greek is never used with reference to our Lord. Never. He never was a slave. He was a son. In a very special sense. He was a free man. From his birth as a man, that was true. So, he could give voluntarily that which was freely his as a sacrifice for sin. He did. But that isn't true of any of his footstep followers. We have absolutely nothing in ourselves worthy of the Lord's acceptance in a sacrificial way. We needed the imputed merit of his sacrifice. And a free will offering. You know that Amal churches speak a lot about a free will offering. Well, that there's a free will offering connected with the true church. That's a free will offering of ourselves in consecration. And with it, we offer all. Not only what we think we have, but all that we might have had, had we waited for restitution. All our earthly hopes and expectations are upon the altar of sacrifice that we have made a covenant with the Lord by sacrifice, and he has accepted it. But here was one, a certain one, among the many, perhaps, that may have been immeasurably candidates for this peculiar office and honor of the Lord selected one, Charles T. Russell. It just happened that his name was Russell. If it hadn't been Russell, it would have been someone else. For the time had come for this prophecy to be fulfilled, and for the Lord to use such a one as his mouthpiece in sending a harvest message unto his people. In the 14th chapter of Revelation, remember, this is pictured. One coming out of the temple, crying unto him that was seated upon the cloud, he who wore the crown and had a sharp sickle, saying, "Thrust in thy sickle and reap. Time to reap has come, and the harvest of the earth is ripe." That was to happen sometime, and the Lord in this, in the 13th chapter of Matthew, I think it is, said that the harvest would be the end of the age, that the age would end in a harvest, and the harvest of the wheat. Brother Russell in two instances speaks of the great company as also being wheat. And so you see that perhaps the harvest is much broader, deeper, far-reaching than the successful little flock. Though they are the cream of the wheat, naturally. You know, there are different grades of wheat, even in nature. Seemingly, this illustration may apply in the measure of these figurative wheat. We once thought that the harvest was a period of 40 years. Now, I'm not saying that isn't a correct thought. It could be. And this period of 40 years is based upon an analogy that we draw with reference to the experiences of the natural house of Israel And in 69-70 A.D., Roman armies, first Vespasian, and then his son, Titus. Titus took the city of Jerusalem, broke down its walls, and destroyed the temple, ended the national polity of Israel. And that was from A.D. 29, A.D. 69 was a period of 40 years. I know some of us just take a knife and just cut that right on, sharp. And if we correctly visualize the Lord's dealings back through the ages, we find that His providences do not always cut such a sharp line of demarcation. I do not know. I am glad to believe that there's been some harvesting going on. You know, sometimes we quote, and I think rather erroneously, the words of Brother Russell in 1916, "The harvest goes grandly on." Well, that was 43 years ago. And surely we can't use that phrase, as Brother Russell used it, with the same confidence in which he used it then, for things have happened to us since 1916. Important events have come to pass. We've been fulfilling prophecy. You know, I have nothing to do with the door. Never opened it. I have no right to close it. Some argue that the door is closed. Well, I don't know. Sometimes I have my suspicions. But I have no conviction in respect to it. And, you know, suspicions are not to be used as convictions. The matter is really in the Lord's hand. But something is happening to us. Something has been happening to us. Maybe you've got the solution. I haven't. The Lord has. And I often wish that I understood the solution that He is making of the problems that confront us today. And there are problems. Everywhere we go, problems confronting the brethren, questions, and there was an answer. And echo just answers answer. I don't feel qualified to give the answer. As I said, I sometimes have suspicions, ideas, but they're not facts. You know, one thing that pains me in all this is the tendency to question motives. Even if I don't agree with a brother or sister, I like to attribute a good motive in their mistakes, if they've made mistakes. Maybe it's me that makes the mistake. I've made them before. I may make them again. But to question motives, only the Lord can read the heart. Maybe if I was in a similar situation, under similar circumstances, it would be me making the mistake that I think someone else is making. Probably would be. Well, no question in my mind in respect to this fourth sign, the angel to the church at Laodicea. A few years ago down here near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on the north side, I visited a private cemetery. Maybe some of you have been there. And there's a tombstone there. And on that tombstone is a picture. It's the picture of Brother Russell. And under it is carved the Laodicean Messenger. Have we been deceived? Did we make a mistake? Is that a lie? I don't think so. Yes, the most important sign, the presence of the Son of Man. One with which some of us have had the privilege and now carry the responsibility of having known him personally and been in a measure associated with him and in his ministry. Yes, the sign of the Son of Man has appeared in the heavens. What are you going to do? May the Lord have you blessed.
Thank you, Brother Baker. We see the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens. And it indicates, by all indications we believe the Lord is present. And he's marching grandly on, bringing the kingdom of God to full fruition. What's the number of that hymn, Our King is Marching
171.
On? 171. 171, I think to many of us, the New Brunswick Convention has already started. To be continued tomorrow morning. Hymn number 171, Our King is Marching On.